Thank you. Our second case today, a piece of quiet after the alarm, is 10 AP 3015 Sawson versus Town of Black Creek Board of Review. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Sawson is R. George Burnett. Counsel, you may proceed.
May it please the Court, I'm George Burnett, and I represent the appellant Frank Sawson on this case, which deals with the taxation of his hunting land. The town of Black Creek called the hunting land productive commercial forest land, and as a result taxed it at the rate attributable to that classification.
Counsel, can I please, at the outset, I think the words we use are really important here. I said this to my colleagues this morning. And this is basically an issue about classification, right?
Correct.
Okay. So help me out here if you can. What was this property classified as, technically, the actual words in the classification, before the assessor did the subject assessment?
I don't know exactly, but my sense is it was classified as productive forest land before the assessment.
Is that in the record anywhere?
I couldn't find it. I had the same question.
Okay.
But I looked at the application or the challenge to the assessment, and I looked at some of the tax bills and that type of thing that are part of the circuit court record, and that seemed to be the situation.
Okay. Is there a stipulation that that's the situation, or is that in the record? Is that?
I think it's in the record, but I'm trying to answer your question as candidly as I can.
Okay. Well. Okay. And then the assessor comes in and classifies it as low-grade woods. Is that right?
That's the word he used at the hearing. The Court of Appeals noted that there is no such classification and treated it as synonymous with productive forest land.
What did he write in his report?
The report's not part of the record.
Okay.
There's a 6 or 7 page transcript of the proceeding, the hearing, and at the hearing he continually referred to it as low-grade woods.
Okay. So we don't have an actual written report, but we have his testimony, and his testimony as to classification is really not a classification.
Yeah.
Is that an existing classification?
No.
Those three words?
No.
Okay. So do you view that as a change in the classification?
That's not been vigorously argued in this case. It's noted both at the court and in briefing. I think the parties, I think a fair reading of the proceedings below is that the town board declined to change the classification from what it was.
So then it was appealed to the board, and the board didn't change the classification.
In their words, they took no action.
Okay. So as far as you can tell, this was productive forest land. It didn't change with the assessor, and it didn't change with the board?
Well, not exactly. The classification was never challenged.
I'm talking about the classification, not valuation.
Right.
Classification.
Classification was never challenged until the assessment was substantially increased.
The valuation. I'm trying to separate those two things out.
Yes, until the valuation was substantially increased by 150% or so, then the classification was challenged.
Because I understood this to be, at least in part, a case about whether a board or an assessor can change the classification of property.
That's at the center of the case.
But is that really the issue here if the classification never changed, is my point?
Yes, it's the issue because that is the challenge to the assessment. There's nothing in the statute that binds a taxpayer to a certain classification once that classification is made. You can go for years without challenging the classification and then challenge it.
I understand that, but I thought the challenge was to the fact that someone changed the classification.
No.
Okay. So you both agree that the classification has always remained the same? productive forest lands?
If I could hearken back to my original answer, I don't think that's precisely in the record, but I think a fair reading of the record is it did not change.
But for purposes of our deciding this, that's not the issue.
That's
the
not
change
the issue.
In classification.
The change is not the issue. It's whether it was correctly classified.
Okay. All right. You've really helped me. Thank you. So there's no forfeiture or waiver on classification. You can keep paying the taxes on that for years and years and years and wake up and then say, hey, not true. Or the nature of the land can change.
Exactly.
But
you can.
It doesn't matter.
What seemed to have inspired it here is the change in the valuation.
Right, because if he could change the classification, he pays half.
Right.
Right. That makes sense.
Does an assessor have some sort of duty to annually review a classification?
I think the statute says that assessments have to be reviewed every 5 years. I don't think there's anything in the statute that specifically addresses a duty to review a classification. So as I regard it, basically you have, to pick up on what Justice Ziegler said, you have three key words. Keyword number one is an assessment. Keyword number two is evaluation. Keyword number three is a classification. If we put it down in mathematical terms, valuation plus classification equals assessment, I think, and that's about as far as my simple math can go.
Well, so the assessment is the final number against which the tax rate is applied.
Correct.
And you get to the assessment by looking at the valuation.
I'm sorry?
You get to the assessment by looking at the valuation of the land, what a reasonable buyer and a reasonable seller would agree as
correct.
To the price. And the classification is based on what?
The classification, there are seven categories ranging from residential to other. Here, two are important. Undeveloped is classification number five, and productive forest land is classification number six.
And are these defined terms somewhere?
They're defined in 7.32 subpart 2. Both are
regulations.
Are defined terms in the statute. And the reason the classification's important for this case is subpart 4 of that same statute indicates that if the land is classified as undeveloped, the assessment is 50% of the full value. If it's productive forest land, the assessment is 100%.
Mr. Burnett, is it a matter of contention in this case that your client holds this 10 acres for the purpose mainly for hunting?
I think that's central to the case, primarily based on the definitions, the statutory definitions that are involved.
And the administrative code. And that's what I want to ask you about. So it seems to me that everybody kind of recognized, that's my sense from going through the record, that everybody recognized he holds it, he uses it for hunting.
He uses it for hunting, and that's important here because
Mr. Burnett, I agree with you. It is important, and I assure you you're going to have time to say what you want to say. But one thing that's been on my mind is how do you harmonize, then, the idea that the 10 acres is being held as hunting land and the comparables at the town board meeting, the assessor testified in regard to the comps of $2,750 per acre, which I assume, but I don't have a perfect recall, was also hunting land.
Pretty much the same.
And so how does your client address the Chapter 5 of the assessment manual, which I think in our case, Walgreens, we've instructed these assessors, you have to follow the assessment manual, where it includes, within the definition of productive forest land, forested areas primarily held for hunting.
I think that the manual that we're referring to is attached to...
It is in the appendix.
In the respondent's appendix. And as I read it, it was...
The part I'm looking at is class forest lands, class 6, second paragraph, productive forest lands and related services in this classification are determined primarily on the use of the land. And then it goes on to say some things about grazing, livestock, and fishing and hunting. And then three paragraphs down, and this is a very relatively short sentence, it says, forested areas primarily held for hunting, trapping, or in the operation of game preserves should be classified as forest unless clearly operated as a commercial enterprise or exempt.
The short answer is that the first paragraph you read and the last paragraph are contradictory.
It's productive forest versus forest?
Yes, for this reason. They're contradictory because the first sentence says, this class includes land which is producing or capable of producing commercial forest products. Productive forest lands and related services are determined primarily on the use of the land.
Yeah.
The problem we have here is a problem of both evidence and definition. Everybody agrees or should agree that the primary use of this land was hunting. It was not commercial forest products.
And that stuck with me until I read three paragraphs down.
Right, and that's why it's contradictory, because they say forested land primarily held for hunting, trapping, or in the operation of game preserve should be classified as forest. This manual, while the statute indicates that the assessor should use it, can never supersede the statute, the word and decree of the legislature. So let's go back and look at how the legislature has defined productive forest land. In subpart 2 of 70.32, it says productive forest land means land that is producing or is capable of producing commercial forest product and is not otherwise classified in this subsection. So there are a number of elements there. Number one, it has to be land easily satisfied. Number two, it has to be producing forest products, not occurring here.
Or
classified or capable of producing forest products. That's possible, not based on this record, but possible.
No, but it doesn't matter if he wants to use it for hunting or he wants to just look at it. If it's capable of producing forest. That's
capable
how you
producing
would...
forest products, but the legislature added another word.
Okay.
Commercial.
Okay.
Now, what evidence is there in this record?
Whose burden is to put in the evidence?
The burden is unspecified in the statute. 7, and that really goes to the crux of one of the 2 points in this case. If we look at 70.47, 8H, that talks about what the assessor is supposed to do at the hearing. And subpart H says the assessor shall provide the specific information about the validity of the valuation to which objection is made, and shall provide to the board the information that the assessor used to determine that valuation. That would suggest to me that the assessor has to come to the hearing and he has to explain to the board what he did and why he did it.
No, you got a little problem in this case, that the statutes talk about valuation. This is not a valuation case, it's a classification case.
So if I am right and the town is wrong on what valuation means, then what I just read is not germane. But neither is the next sentence, which is subpart I, and that's what the town relies on. Subpart I says, the board shall presume that the assessor's valuation is correct. That presumption may be rebutted by a sufficient showing by the objector that the valuation is incorrect. So that places the burden on the taxpayer to rebut the valuation. But if the challenge is to a classification, then this doesn't apply. And there is nothing in this statute that puts the burden on Mr. Sousen to come in and show it's not commercially viable.
Well, the other way of saying it is nothing in the statute saying that there's a presumption of the validity of the assessor's assessor's classification or the board's classification.
Right. So we're silent. The statute is silent. We have no direction from the legislature on that subject. So how do we solve the problem? Justice Bradley?
Thank you. What part does the oftentimes strict standard of cert review then play in the analysis? If we have no direction, cert review may suggest a certain kind of deference to the Board of Review determination. Can you respond?
Yes. I think it's important to separate what the burden of production, burden of proof, and the very deferential standard that the courts apply to the Board of Review's findings. In this particular case, I think the deferential standard basically requires the court to ensure that the board stuck to its jurisdiction, did not enter an arbitrary ruling, that its factual findings are reasonable, and it followed the law. I think the court has said that many times in many places. In this particular case, what do we have to look at? We have a 5 or 6 page transcript of proceedings. And in that 5 or 6 page transcript, we have two things going on. Mr. Sousen comes in with a series of maps and he says, look at this, this is wetlands, it fits the definition of undeveloped property. And the assessor says, but there are trees on it, so it fits the definition of forest. In this discussion, there is no discussion about whether this is commercially viable. We don't know what kind of trees they are. We don't know the volume. We don't know the
size. Low-grade cedar. We know that. That's part of the
low-grade cedar. But we don't know if there is any logger who can come in and make any money clearing this woods if Mr. Sousen wants to go that direction.
How do you respond to your opposing counsel's argument that your client is artificially divorcing classification from valuation? In other words, valuation follows classification because, as we all know, the value of a parcel of land can vary greatly depending upon its classification.
Well, the way I address that is out of respect for the legislature. This court has ruled many times, many places, that the legislature chooses its words carefully.
And if they had meant classification, they would have said it.
They would have said it. If there is a presumption that the assessment is correct, that's what they would have said, but they didn't. They said there is a presumption that the valuation is correct. If there is a presumption that the classification is correct, that's what they would have said, but they didn't.
Here's my problem. One might pay more, or another person may pay less, but one may pay more if there's a opportunity for commercial forest, commercial logging, right? Someone else may pay more for quiet land to hunt on, but my assumption is it would be worth more if you can get money out of it on the market.
It would be worth more potentially if there was a buyer out there for these woods.
That's right. So if you were going to, valuation is what a reasonable buyer and a reasonable seller would agree on as the price, right?
Right. Full value is what the statute
calls
it. Yeah,
full value, but that's what the case law says. I am pretty close. Okay. So if you're going to figure value, you have to know what's the opportunity for use of this property. I mean, the value is going to be different if it's agriculture and you're going to farm it, or you can develop it and put 1,000 homes on it and sell it for that.
Right.
Or use it yourself. So how can you separate classification and valuation? That's one part of it. Second part of it is, when did these, I have not checked the statutory history, but when did the classification statutes come into effect versus the general valuation, which has been a long time?
I don't know when the statute talked about, they first began talking about classification, but I did go back to the statutes in 2000 to discern whether there was any change in the use of the legislature's terms, and there was. So we know at least classification was in play in 2000.
Council? Okay, but the valuation is of long standing.
Valuation is of long standing, but classification is part of the statutes. And you have to have both to equal an assessment. Mm-hmm. Did I answer your question
yes,
fully?
Yes, thank you.
Justice Ziegler?
Sub 4, to me, seems to answer the Chief's question and your argument. Sub 4, I think, shows that classification and valuation are separate things, because if they weren't, you couldn't assess 50% of the full value.
I think that's right.
They have to be separate components that equal the assessment under sub 4. Otherwise, if the value always was based upon the classification, then you wouldn't do a 50% of the full value, because the value would be 50%. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes, and to add to that point, I would point the court to subpart 2 of the same statute. Subpart 1 talks about how the assessor goes about setting the valuation. Subpart 2 says the assessor, having fixed a value, shall enter the same opposite the proper track in the assessment roll, and then it goes on to describe the classifications. So they are separate. They're two parts of a whole, but very, very different. If I could finish, I don't think I gave Justice Bradley a full answer to her question. The question was, if I recall it right, how do I deal with the deference given to the board? Here, the board's explanation of its decision was almost bereft of all analysis. And what I would hearken to, I looked to see if there were cases out there that talked about how little evidence the board needed to have before the court gives it carte blanche, makes its decision is unassailable. And I found nothing. Perhaps there is something out there. But I did find a decision that you had written in the criminal context, State versus Galleon, and I think it's analogous, primarily because the deference the board is given comes from its quasi-judicial capacity. What the court wrote in paragraph 1, in all Anglo-American jurisprudence, a principal obligation of the judge is to explain the reasons for his actions. His decisions will not be understood by the people and cannot be reviewed by the appellate courts unless the reasons for decisions can be examined. And then the court goes on in paragraph 19 to talk about what it is to exercise discretion and how to explain it.
That's a good opinion. I'm glad you're talking about it. But my life experience is that some of these boards of review, that would be a bit, the Galleon opinion would be a bit too much to saddle them with.
Well, lay people serving for not a lot of money, I agree. That's been my experience as well. But on the other hand, you know, Justice Marshall wrote in McCullough versus Maryland, the power to tax is the power to destroy. I don't think we can give boards composed of private citizens any less leeway than we would give to a judge simply because they're unsophisticated.
As I recall, well, I don't know if I agree with that premise because I don't know. I'll have to think about it more. But as I recall here, and I would be paraphrasing it, essentially after the, at the end of the seven-page transcript, much of which was unintelligible, they said something like, I think we're going to stick with what we have,
right.
Paraphrasing it. And is there any more analysis that you think is required?
Well, I think the second paragraph in the Galien decision says the term discretion contemplates a process of reasoning. This process must depend on facts that are of record and that are or that are reasonably derived from inferences from the record and a conclusion based on a logical rationale founded upon proper legal standards. In this case, the assessment was modest. But boards don't just sit on modest assessments. They have tremendous power, and I'm sorry, I see my light is on.
You may finish answering the question, Mr. Burnett.
On rebuttal, I will talk about the last point I wanted to make, which is why the court should not defer through a presumption to a local board. I think taxpayers, the people of Wisconsin, deserve more, and the court, this is a central core function of the courts. Thank you.
Chief.
Justice Prosser.
It seems to me, Mr. Burnett, you are making an argument here that really greatly transcends this individual case. If I can summarize, the statute talks about land that is producing or is capable of producing commercial forest products and is not otherwise classified. That's the statute.
Correct.
Okay, then we go to the property classification manual under Forest Lands Class 6. This class includes land which is producing or capable of producing commercial forest products.
Correct.
That's consistent. And then we go down a little bit. Forest lands include those forested areas which are being managed or set aside to grow tree crops for industrial wood or to obtain tree products such as sap, bark, or seeds. That seems to be consistent. But then it says, forested areas with no commercial use made of the trees, including cutover, are also to be included in this classification. And it seems to me that that sentence, which you talked about the inconsistency or contradictory nature, that sentence seems, in a sense, to cover what we're talking about in this case.
That sentence, I think, defies what the legislature wrote when it defined productive forest land. It has to be commercial. It has to be commercially viable. And there isn't a finding in this record that that's the case. We had an assessor say, this is forest because there are trees on it. And we had a property owner say, it's wetlands because it's shown on two official maps.
Do you think forested land is the same as forest land? Isn't this referring to when you...
There's two types of forest land, agricultural land and forest land.
There's forested areas. That doesn't mean, for example, when you go in with an operation and take out trees and do cutover and
logging would be productive forest land.
You may not log them for commercial purposes, but you may do it to improve the property, let sunlight in. You know, it affects the property differently. I mean, you have to do that when you have...
Right, you have to clear the land on occasion. But the legislature wrote, when it defined productive forest land, land that is producing or capable of producing commercial forest products. And the question for the court here is, because this is a lay board unsophisticated, do they get a pass for offering no evidence that this was capable of producing anything commercial?
Right, but the point of Justice Prosser's sentence is, do you really think forested areas, that's a different term than forest lands. Forested areas. Areas that are being forested and cut over.
Yeah, I must not be following the question.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Do I back up and go back to the manual?
Was the board and the assessor following the manual, or were they not following the manual?
I don't think there was any reference made to the manual at the hearing. And my memory is that what Mr. Sawson came to the hearing with was a pamphlet that's in the record describing some of the things that are in the manual, but I don't think that there's any reference that the manual was at the hearing or that the assessor referred to it. That's why the statute dealing with what he's supposed to do in proving valuation might be helpful. This assessor was supposed to come in and tell the board what he did and why he did it. He didn't do that. He left it to the taxpayer to challenge it. And I think that's wrong on a number of levels.
Is there a burden attached to seeking a change in classification?
Seeing a change in classification?
Seeking a change.
Seeking? I think that's the taxpayer's right every time there's a reassessment.
A right?
I mean, yeah. I think there's nothing that prohibits a taxpayer after owning the property classified as productive forest land for 15 years to come in and say, no, this is wrong, and now it's meaningful, and I think you should reclassify.
And if he didn't come in early, he just loses the right because there are statutes of limitations on when you can attack the assessment.
Right. I don't know if there's a statute of limitations applicable here.
No, I'm not suggesting it is because he did it timely.
But what I'm really asking is not whether someone has the right to request or ask for a change in classification, but when that person makes the request, do they have any burden?
Okay, I follow. A burden to come in and demonstrate that the classification is wrong. And does the government have to do nothing other than respond? And I'd say no for a couple of reasons. Number one, there is no presumption on classifications. When we go back to the 70.47 statute, the presumption relates to valuation, not classification. So we're starting with from a clean slate, and usually the party advocating for a tax has the burden or responsibility to establish it. That's the way it should be in this country. I mean, the taxation of a government of its citizens is enormously important. And it is the government's responsibility to establish that the tax is appropriate and should be paid.
Mr. Burnett, would you agree that if you looked at many of these cases dealing with objections to the ultimate payment of property taxes, that the courts and the parties mix up and treat the same classification, assessment, and valuation, and apply the presumptions to
smear? I don't have enough experience in the field to know how common.
I'm just looking at the case law. The case law goes way back. We've got valuation for many, many years as the basis.
I found no case
cases.
Law.
And we get classification as early as at least my notes show of 1931. Valuation goes back to the 19th century. Classification comes in 1931 as referred to the Hensel case, but it didn't matter in terms of assessment. It doesn't matter until you start applying different rates.
Right. I think we agree, and let me just say what I think. I found no cases, short of this one, that ever challenged classification.
Okay.
So
they may not have been a challenge, but there's a lot of talk in the cases about valuation, assessment valuation, assessed value, assessor's valuation, and they encompass the whole field.
It's not unusual for, I would agree with you, that in some of the decisions where it's not a meaningful distinction, there may be some interchanging on those kinds of issues, but I would hearken back to really what we begin with here, and that is how did the legislature use the term, and it used those three terms separately, valuation, assessment, and classification.
Justice Bradley.
The discussion has just been on who has the burden here. And I look at objections to valuation, and that is, of course, the statute 70.477A. And that statute is referenced in the form used, objection form for property assessments. And the very first paragraph, and this is in the record, Exhibit A, the very first paragraph of this form sets forth that statute. And although the heading of the statute is objection to valuation, and may I say that the objection form for real estate property assessment quotes the statute verbatim initially. And it says, the Board of Review may not hear an objection to the amount or valuation. So is amount something different than valuation?
No, not that I would.
Well, you know, normal statutory construction would say they wouldn't say two things if they only meant one thing and they had an or in between. So it seems to me that that might be the nut of part of our analysis. What did they mean by amount?
Under that section, and maybe you have to address this when you come back, I was thinking along the same lines, wondering what that meant. But I also wondered, is there anywhere in the statutes that provide for the opportunity to object to classification? Assuming you're right that valuation and classification equal assessment, and there's three separate and distinct concepts, assessment is made up of a combination of valuation and classification, what's the subsection that allows an objection to classification?
That's a fundamental question that I don't have the immediate answer to. I can answer it this way. No one has suggested that Mr. Salson did not have the right to object to classification. It is a distinction with regard to the point Justice Bradley makes with regard to valuation. Because, and it's certainly, the word assessment appears separately from valuation throughout this statute. I can't think off the top of my head any situation where valuation and the amount of valuation would be different.
One interpretation, and I'm just off the cuff on this, but amount of assessment. I mean, it's amount of something. It's not
the 50% thing, maybe.
I'll have where to study that more. But it's not the same thing. Valuation is different. And you can object to the amount or the valuation.
You know, maybe the simple answer is just context. No person shall be allowed in any action or proceeding to question the amount or valuation of property. So maybe the word amount talks about the amount of property being assessed. or the value of property being assessed.
The reason I point this particular statute out is because it does go to the burden. As the statute continues, and such person in good faith presented evidence to such board in support of substantive objection, it seems to me that suggests that the objector has to present evidence.
Right. I mean, I would think that, that would always be the case if you're going to object, but that's different than the burden. Ultimately, the burden is almost synonymous here, I would think, with presumptions. My time is way past. Thank you for your indulgence.
Thank you. Counsel, you have time for rebuttal. Counsel.
May it please the Court, my name is Michael Mangini and I represent the Town of Black Creek Board of Review. I'll just respond to a couple things that were addressed by counsel. I think we both, I don't know if we'd call it stipulated or just didn't contest that this idea of low-grade cedar was a subset of productive forest land. I think that that's how the Court of Appeals addressed it, if not the Circuit Court. But it was my understanding was that it was assessed as productive forest land before, and there was a push to do reclassification or reassessment of all the property in the town of Black Creek, which it did, and then this objection came up. But the objection was to reclassify it as undeveloped from productive forest land. First of all, the town's position here is that the entire assessment gets the presumption of correctness. Case law going back to the early 1900s holds that the entire assessment, not just the valuation, is prima facie correct and is binding on the Board of Review in the absence of evidence showing it to be incorrect. That's State v. Williams, 160 Wiss 648. That's from 1915. In 2001, the court in Nankin versus Village of Shorewood noted that the court must give presumptive weight to the assessor's assessment. That's 2001 WI 92.
And you read assessment to mean include valuation plus classification?
Yeah, as counsel argued initially, that it would be it would include both evaluation and classification. In Nankin, the court specifically cited to Wisconsin Statute 70.49 sub 2, which is the statute on the affidavit of the assessor. That statute provides, quote, the value of all real and personal property entered into the assessment roll to which such affidavit is attached by the assessor shall, in all actions and proceedings involving such values, be presumptive evidence that all such properties have been justly and equitably assessed in proper relationship to each other.
So even though the statute says values, the cases have said assessed.
Right, and until the 2003-2004 Budget Act 33, which changed the statute to provide that under Section 70.32 sub 4, undeveloped and agricultural forests would be valued at 50% of their fair market value. Before that, it didn't really matter what the classification was. They were all going to be assessed at full value. Until 2003 and 2004, it didn't matter. Now, this classification is going to come up, like in this case.
Well, before this, the classification didn't have anything to do with the ultimate tax bill.
It didn't matter. The statute just didn't address it.
But it might have mattered in other proceedings.
Correct.
Like regulations of use of the land.
Absolutely.
Okay.
I would think, though, that would maybe be zoning, but you're right.
Where in the statute does it provide for the opportunity to object to the classification?
Well, the town's argument, one of its arguments, is that it's inextricable to the valuation, that it is part of the valuation, because if you look at valuation, you have full value, but you also have assessed value.
Well, if assessment equals classification plus valuation. Classification and valuation are two separate things. The statute speaks to objecting to the valuation.
Yeah, the classification is under the valuation statute, though. It just states that the assessor fixes a value, but then classifies it, but if it's then classified as undeveloped or agricultural forest, that it's assessed at 50%. So that would directly affect the assessed value. So that's why we argue that it's inextricable.
And I guess I'm thinking of this mathematically now, but
right.
You really see classification as a subset of valuation, not classification plus valuation equals assessment. You really see the valuation as encompassing the classification. You can't get a valuation without the classification.
You can get a full value, but when it comes to undeveloped and agricultural forest, you can't get assessed value. The classification is critical when it comes to those two classifications. So I agree, it's tough to break it up if you want to look at it mathematically, but then if you look at the statute, there's not a statute on valuation and then a statute on classification, and there's no...
But your answer to that is because classification is part of valuation. It's not that it's a separate component that added with valuation equals the assessment. It's just part of the valuation.
Right, right.
Counsel, in your opening remarks, you alluded to, in your word, a push to reassess property in the township. Is that somewhere in the record that there was an overall plan to reassess everybody's property?
We don't have it in the record.
Is there anything, what seemed to be in the record as far as the transcript where Mr. Sawson appeared and the assessor was present, was an allusion to two comparable sales. That's my recollection. And I think that, coincidentally or not, that the sale price of the comparable property was $2,750 an acre. Is there anything in the record to indicate that it was those two comparable sales which led to the reassessment of Mr. Sawson's land?
I don't think that there's anything in the record. My understanding was that the Department of Revenue contacted the town and said that, on average, the total property in the town was assessed at like 35. I can't remember the exact percentage, but it was a percentage of the total value compared to the rest of the state. So it encouraged them to do a reassessment, and that's why they did it.
Is there anything in the record to indicate what the classifications of the two comparable properties were?
Not that I know of.
Okay. Thank you.
Counselor, I would draw your attention to 70.47. I don't know if you have it close at hand, but it is the section in which, in subsection 8, there is a hearing on someone's objection to the assessment. Subsection I says the board shall presume the assessor's valuation is correct, but when you move into subsection 9, okay, so going from 8, where you're talking about the hearing and what the board does, in 9 it says from the evidence before it, the board shall determine whether the assessor's assessment is correct. Well, there's a presumption the valuation is correct, but you were talking about assessment includes classification, and it doesn't appear there's any presumption, even though the board is to make a decision on whether the assessment is correct.
Yeah, the statutes don't make it clear. Like I said, though, the case law going back to as early as 1910 and as recent as 2001 shows that the court said that the entire assessment gets the presumption. I think part of that is based on the affidavit of the assessor. Once he puts that information in the affidavit and certifies it as a public official, that they presume that to be correct, and they force the taxpayer to, if they want to object to the valuation or the value or the classification, that they can do that. But the burden's going to be on them to show that it's incorrect. Counsel, but you're right, the statute doesn't make that clear.
No, the statute certainly doesn't. It talks about they're changing the assessment, but presuming only that the valuation...
The manual, however, if you look at on page 18.1 of the manual, it provides that the Board of Review is bound to accept the assessor's assessment as correct unless there is competent testimony uncontradicted by other evidence which proves the assessment to be incorrect. And it further provides on the same page on 18-1, based only on that testimony, the Board of Review must decide whether an individual has proven the assessor's assessment incorrect.
Counsel, maybe I misunderstood when I was talking math with you a little while ago. But if valuation, I understood you and counsel to have separate mathematical equations on how you get an assessment. His is valuation plus classification equals assessment. I thought yours was valuation can't be determined without classification. You need a classification to determine a valuation, and then you get the assessment. So in other words, classification is a subset of valuation. So, for example, when they talk about appealing or the deference due to a valuation, that includes the deference due to a classification because classification is a subset of valuation. That's what I understood your answer to be, and that would, I think, be your answer to Justice Rogensack, or isn't it?
No, that's correct. And it really only applies when you're talking about undeveloped land or agricultural forest, because that's the only time that the classification is going to affect the assessed value for purposes of a taxpayer. The taxpayer is not going to object to the classification. I know that Chief Justice said that there's some other instances, and I think that there probably are. I haven't thought of any others, but I think it comes into play, and I don't think you can really separate them when you're talking about undeveloped and agricultural forest.
I'm not sure about whether this subset kind of argument is helpful or hurtful or correct, because I marked down in my notes about your saying it's a classification is a subset of valuation. I think you make the same argument that classification is a subset of assessed value, and that what goes into assessed value is in the assessment, because what goes into the assessment is the valuation times the percent that the legislature has told you to knock off.
Correct.
And that gives you the assessed value. So you can shift that subset, I think.
No, because that
you do it. But anyway.
That percent only comes in when you have a particular classification. So you have to know the classification in order to have 50% of it.
Let me see if this has anything to do with the current questions. And that is the case of Hensel versus Town of Wilson, which says the assessment of real property is done by two different stages. Number one, evaluation, and number two, and then assessment. Is that a correct statement of the law? It's a 1972 case.
It sounds correct. It seems to be, though, that it's part of the assessment process. You get the assessment by looking at both, the overall assessment. And if you look at your tax bill, you have the fair market value, and then you have the assessed value. There's two different values there, and you only get to the assessed value if you look at both the full fair market value and then the classification.
So is the assessment of real property done in two different stages, evaluation and then assessment? Is that a correct statement of the law?
Did you say valuation or?
Evaluation and, excuse me, I should speak more clearly. The assessment of real property is done by two different stages, evaluation and then assessment. Let me tell you, the reason I point to this and ask this question is because we have case after case after case that says there's a presumption of correctness to the assessment. So, I want to know, it sounds to me that the evaluation is different than the assessment.
Are you implying that the evaluation is the classification?
I'm not, I don't know. What do you think? I mean, I think there's room to argue that part of the assessment is the classification.
Right.
That you get first a value evaluation, but the assessment encompasses a more than that.
Right.
You know, and so that's what I'm wondering, what the Hensel versus Town of Wilson case means by two different stages.
Part of me thinks, too, that the assessor goes out and evaluates the property and will look at what's on the property, how much he's looking at or she's looking at, look at comparables. Maybe that's the evaluation, the evaluation, and then the assessment is taking that evaluation and then valuing it, classifying it, and then that's how you come up with your assessment.
But Mr. Burnett argued, if I understood his argument, that a case that says there's a presumption of the correction of the assessment, presumption of correction of the assessment, violates the statute. The statute says you presume valuation is correct, and valuation and assessment are two different things.
I think
he's
so.
Not arguing valuation. He's saying his client's assessment is wrong because it's based on a wrong classification, and there's nothing in the statutes, regardless of what this case law says, that says there's a presumption of correctness of assessment. In loads of cases that say exactly what Justice Bradley said and use a multitude of terminology. And if I understood Mr. Burnett, he says, let's go back to basics. Let's go right back and look at the statute, and it says valuation, not assessment.
But 70.49 Prent 2
7.49 Part 2, okay.
Gives a presumption to the affidavit of the assessor.
And in that affidavit, you're saying includes classification?
That includes the entire assessment.
And that therefore includes the classification.
And if you look at one case of State v. Wilcutts, which is 143 WIS 449, it states the record of the assessment by itself made a prima facie case in favor of the work of the assessor. And also in Peninsula Power Company versus Wisconsin Tax Commission, it's a 1928 case, that's 195 Wisconsin 231, the court opine that the affidavit of the assessor as a public officer shall be received as presumptive evidence of the facts therein stated.
Counsel, assuming that the burden is on the taxpayer, what would someone in Mr. Sawson's position have to show in order to demonstrate that the land he owns is undeveloped land?
My experience with handling Board of Review hearings for different municipalities, the taxpayer shows up with an appraiser who's done a complete appraisal, does a report, and testifies as to that report, and probably in this case would testify that the property is made up of swamp and marsh, that the it's only brush, it's not trees or woodlands that are across the property. And basically that the property is useless. But in this case, we just had Mr. Sawson show up with two maps that showed.
Sure, I have them.
Okay.
What happens to a property then, 10 acres, 5 of it is wetlands, marsh, and then there's forest on the other part? What does that get classified as?
I'm not a professional appraiser or assessor. I don't know how that would go. I imagine they would look at the primary use.
Well, right, because that's what's in the assessment manual, and that's what Mr. Burnett was referring to before. Productive forest lands and related services in this classification are determined primarily on the use of the land.
Right. And it would be its highest and best use of the land based on the opinion of the assessor or the appraiser. They couldn't just take Mr. Sawson's word for it and say, you know, because he doesn't use it and he thinks it's useless, then we're gonna say it's undeveloped. They're gonna look at the highest and best use based on the characteristics of the property and based on that make their assessment.
You just sparked a recollection, which is a question that's been on my mind since I originally read this. Do you know, or does the record indicate what low-grade cedar is?
My understanding of it is that
a lower grade of regular cedar.
Right, it's a subset under the productive forest. That it's not this probably really valuable wood product, but you could probably sell it. Some low grade. It's a grade. It's just a low grade cedar. And I think, again, it's not clear in the record that it's that means that it's capable of producing commercial forest products. That was just what they said. I can't stand here today.
Is there anything in the record to indicate that this 10 acres is capable of producing a commercial forest crop?
From my review, I look at it as if, because the assessor said it's low-grade cedar, that in and of itself would show at least that it's producing.
Is there a commercial market for low-grade cedar?
I don't know.
Well, okay, so let's set aside low-grade cedar. Say Mr. Sawson said, well, gee, instead of using this as hunting land or recreational, I want to set this up as an ongoing tree farm for logging. Anything to indicate in the record that the land could be used for that?
Not that I know of.
Well, it's capable of using. Look, I've checked your briefs. No one cited 70.492
right.
for the presumption. The statute cited talked about valuation. So is the affidavit of the assessor in the record?
It's not.
So how can we rely on, if I understand your argument, the assessor had an affidavit before the meeting, shall attach to the completed assessment roll an affidavit in a form prescribed by the DOR. The value of the property entered into the assessment roll to which the affidavit is attached by the assessor shall, in all actions involving values, be presumptive evidence that all properties have been justly and equitably assessed. That's the word you're hanging your hat on, because we've moved from values into assessed, right? Which includes classification, wherever you put it. So it has to be, it was equitably assessed in the proper relation to each other. But we don't have it in the record, so it's hard then to justify. I don't know what his assessed value was. You're saying the assessed value was the full fair market value.
Not
decreased by 50% because it would have been under a good classification for the taxpayer.
Right. Yeah. The record, the affidavit itself wasn't in the record. There was testimony from Mr. Sawson. It also included in his objection what he was contesting. I think that included what was on the or what was in the affidavit, which would have been the information on the assessment roll itself.
Okay.
As far as the way I look at it, as if you forced for purposes of the valuation, when you're contesting an excessive valuation, and you have a taxpayer come in and he bears the burden, if we now say, well, you only do that for the valuation, you don't do that for the classification, so we're going to force the assessor, we're going to change the burden, the assessor or the taxpayer can object, and then we're going to put the burden on the assessor to show that it's correct. It just seems to go against the whole idea of the presumption and how the objections work in the first place. I think it also opens the door for a ton of litigation to be able to allow the taxpayer to say, you know what, I want to be an undeveloped because I own some hunting land that let's make the assessor show that it's capable of producing commercial forest products or whatever.
And that isn't that the crux of this case? That if there is a presumption of accuracy to the assessor, then the burden of proving it's wrong falls on the taxpayer rather than on the town, which has dozens of pieces of property or hundreds or thousands, depending on the size of the community. And all you want to stop the wheels going, you just file an objection, and then the town or city has to prove each one of them, right?
Correct.
Rather than say, hey, we are going to say valid, the assessment is valid, you, taxpayer, should come in, you know your property, you get the evidence and show it's invalid. That's what this is about.
Correct.
And if it were just a straight valuation case, that's what would happen. Because it's classification, the question is, do the statutes which talk about valuation and the cases which get all these terms botched up, in my opinion, and don't use them consistently, what should this court do?
Counselor, what is in this affidavit?
What do you think the court should do?
Should find that the presumption is afforded to the classification as well as the valuation if you make that distinction between the two.
And what do you base that on? Because we always like to look at the statutes. You base it on 7049?
I base it on that. I base it on the case law, which in these cases has addressed 7049 going back to 1910. I think you look at the Wisconsin Assessment Manual, which the statutes say we turn to for guidance, and the Assessment Manual specifically says that the assessment gets the presumption, and we all agree that the assessment includes the valuation and the classification. And if you look at, for practical purposes, how this is going to work, if you give only the valuation to presumption, but not the classification, we're really opening up the door as to how we're going to deal with these classifications in the future.
Counselor, in the affidavit that's referred to in section 70.49, I too was surprised by the section because I hadn't read it before coming here today and looked at it as the source of a presumption that the assessment as well as the valuation was correct. In that affidavit, is it just a narration that I have assessed the following properties on a roll and in my view they are accurately assessed? Or does it give facts about how each assessment was done?
My understanding is that I don't know if the report is attached to it, but the assessment roll is, I believe, which it sets it out.
Yeah, that's what it says in the statute.
And I believe the assessor then just certifies that that he's done the assessment to the best of his ability, et cetera.
So. And these are true and correct assessments. Correct. Okay, thank you very much.
There's a form, apparently, in the department that sets forth the form of the affidavit. So we just have to look up that form.
I believe there is, but I don't know for sure.
That's what the statute says. In a form prescribed by the Department of Revenue.
May I ask, according to Outagamie County's website, information on wetlands, Outagamie County has approximately 74,221 acres of wetlands in the form of swamps, marshes, and bogs, according to DNR estimates from 1978-79 aerial photography. Do you know how many of those 74,000 acres of wetlands are in the 10 acres owned by Mr. Sousa?
I don't.
Just hypothetically, let's suppose it's six. Does that make any difference in the assessment?
No, I don't think so.
Or classification?
No, I don't think so. As the assessor pointed out, that from his view, almost the entire property was covered with, I believe he called it woodland or forest.
Could Mr. Sawson clear cut the entire 10 acres?
I have no idea.
Suppose he couldn't. Would that possibly be productive forest land if he couldn't cut the trees?
I think it could if the assessor went out and looked and found that trees could grow and that they trees could be capable of producing commercial forest products.
But if the law didn't permit him to cut the trees? Well, what I don't really understand here is that we know precisely, or at least we did in 1978, how many acres of wetlands there were. It's mapped all over the state. Okay, so once you classify something as wetlands, does that have any effect on the classification of property or the valuation of property?
I think it can have an effect on the classification, but again, this isn't a classification as wetlands. It's a classification as undeveloped, and I think part of that is whether it has any use. So the assessor is going to go and take the best information possible and make a determination. If a land includes wetlands but includes commercial forest products and he finds that those are useful, I would think that the assessor would classify it as productive forest land. But if he goes out and sees it's only wetlands, there's no use for the land at all, and it's all just bogs and marsh, then an undeveloped classification may be proper.
Well, bogs and marsh can be perfect for hunting.
Again, I don't know. And another thing, I think it goes to the point, too, that this it doesn't seem to be an exact science. The assessor goes out with his understanding and makes decisions. In some situations, you might have a property that one assessor may say is commercial forest or protective forest land, and another might say it's classified as other or classified as undeveloped. I don't think you say because it includes wetlands, it has to be undeveloped or it has to be productive forest. And I think the manual does say that if it's used as hunting land, it's that becomes secondary nature. Later on, it does say that if it's hunting land, you're going to classify it as productive forest land.
But if it's a bog that's hunting land, that's not then classified as productive forest land. It's just if it's productive forest land that you happen to hunt on, then it's still productive forest land.
To some extent, they assume that if you're – well, I don't know.
It says forested areas primarily held for hunting, trapping, et cetera, should be classified as forest, unless
sure.
Clearly.
So, yeah, then if it was just a – bog or just a bogs, marsh, swamp, then they'd probably classify it as undeveloped. I don't know for sure.
Doesn't it all go back to who is the burden of proof? If the assessor had the burden of proof, where is that proof in the record? If the burden of proof is on the, when I say assessor, I mean town. If the burden of proof is on the taxpayer, then where has the taxpayer shown that this is not, this falls into the his appropriate classification, which he wants at lower taxes? And then is the record that he presents good enough because it's not necessarily directed to the classification in the statute? It may be some other classification. I mean, you may classify land as bogs for one reason, but not classify it as a bog under a different statute, or classify it as productive forest under one statute, but not under another. So isn't that the basic problem here?
I think it is, and then I think you add on to that in ABKA Limited Partnership, it states that when determining whether there's enough evidence to sustain the assessment, all presumptions are in favor of the rightful action of the board. I think you add that on top of it.
But Counselor, if you're correct, what we are giving this property owner in regard to this parcel is a negative burden of proof. He's got to show it's not capable of producing a forested product. Do we really give people negative burdens of proof? I mean, that's kind of a different thing than when you have to prove an element of a claim, which is I've got A and I've got B and I've got C. This you're going to use the presumption for the classification, then he's got a negative burden of proof. He's got to show it. It's not. I don't know of any case that employs a negative burden of proof. But you
does that for the valuation, though. The valuation in both cases, you're proving that the assessment's incorrect or that the valuation.
I'm talking about the classification. classification.
Well, then you're proving that the value, that the classification is incorrect. So you're doing the same thing that you're doing for the valuation.
In the valuation, you can get an assessor to come in and say, nah, this property isn't worth $27,500, it's worth $16,000. And he'll say in his professional view why, but he's testing to a positive, okay? This classification, if they have the burden of proof, requires the property owner to prove a negative. I don't know. I mean, maybe you're right. I'm going to go back and do some more research on 7049-2, tell my law clerk in advance over there. but that bothers me a little bit. You know, I mean, I think the statute is very helpful, but when I think about doing it, I mean, it wasn't so long ago I stood in your spot over there and just did trial work, so I know how hard it is to put together a negative if that's your obligation.
Well, I think you would say that the valuation is in a negative one instance and another maybe a positive. You could also say that trying to prove the classification wrong would be positive because if you prove it to be undeveloped, then you're getting a positive as a 50% of the assessment.
I have to think about it some more. Okay, thank you.
I know my time is up, so thank you.
Right. His up is right. Mr. Burnett.
Let me begin with the statute that we were just introduced to, 70.49, subpart 2. As the Chief Justice noted, that seems to be something of an afterthought. It was not in the briefing, but I had an opportunity to read the statute during argument, and it's worded in a peculiar fashion, especially the presumption. The statute says the value of all real and personal property entered into the assessment roll to which such affidavit is attached by the assessor shall, in all actions and proceedings involving such values, be presumptive evidence that all such properties have been justly and equitably assessed. That's how the town reads it. But they forget the last phrase.
In relation to the
proper relationship to each other. So why would the legislature have put in such an unusual and peculiar phrase? I think it has something to do with the Wisconsin Constitution. And I'll confess I have not researched the issue at all. But in the Wisconsin Constitution, Article 8, Section 1, we have a uniformity clause. The uniformity clause is referred to in Justice Wilcox's dissent in the ABKA case, found at 231 with second 328, specifically at paragraph 77. And this is what Justice Wilcox writes. He says, finally, this assessment also appears to violate the uniformity clause of the Wisconsin Constitution. Article 8, Section 1 provides that the rule of taxation should be uniform. This provision requires not uniformity of methods, but uniformity in results. So I suspect that this statute creates a presumption that when the assessor enters it on the roll, the uniformity clause of the Wisconsin Constitution has been conformed with. I don't think it is a presumption that every assessment that the assessor has created somehow or other is presumptively correct for the reasons that I've already discussed at length. The legislature omitted that precise presumption from 70.47.
Burnett, on a slightly different topic, I'd like to ask you, under your reading of the statute, what would the assessor have to show in order to demonstrate that the land is productive forest land?
I think the assessor should come in and establish, number one, his credentials to make such a judgment. I mean, he certainly has credentials as to how to value land, but what it's used for is perhaps an entirely different question. And then he has presumably already made the judgment that this is productive forest land. It can be commercially used for that purpose. So he should come in and he should explain the type
of capable.
Capable. He should explain the type of trees that are on it, how, in his opinion, it could be effectively logged, how much the volume of the trees that are on the property, the size of the trees, It might help if he has actually consulted a logging company and said, would you have an interest in this? This is the stuff that the assessor, having placed this label on the property, presumably did. He can't go out and guess.
Is there anything in the record, to the best of your knowledge, to indicate that this 10-acre parcel is capable of producing a commercial product?
There is nothing in the record. I believe counsel has already acknowledged that, and that is a major flaw. We have an assessment made in this case based on, by all appearances, guess and speculation. All we have is a board saying, well, this land has a lot of trees on it, so it must be forest. It must be productive forest. It must be commercially productive forest. And that doesn't meet the requirements of the statute and probably doesn't meet due process. The other point I would make is the use of the manual. The use of the manual by the assessor is quite limited. 7.0.32 subpart 1 says real property shall be valued by the assessor in the manner specified in the Wisconsin Property Assessment Manual provided under 7303. Again, it's talking about valuation. The fact that the manual may go afar afield from issues in the statute doesn't make it authoritative. My time is up. Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Burnett. I want to thank both counsel on behalf of the court for their arguments on presumptions and assessments, and of course the case is of great interest to the many communities that rely on property tax, as well as the many people of the state who pay property taxes to these presumptions and the burdens of proof. So I want to thank you both, and the court is in. That concludes our argument on Sousen versus Town of Black Street Board of Review. The court will reconvene at 1:30 to hear its third case this month. Thank you.